Dear listeners, hello and thank you for joining us for this 244th edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. My name is Michelle Mandry and I will be your presenter today. Halloween and Bonfire Night feel a distant memory today, and I just know that while Christmas is a few weeks away yet, in no time at all it will have been and gone. It's been a pretty soggy day today. I can see and hear Cornard Weir from my office window, and it's been running at full pelt. Not a day to venture far from the comfort of a kettle in my book. The river here, the Stour, forms the county border, and looking across the countryside of North Essex, I imagine the hares, deer, mice and rabbits no doubt holed up in burrows or under hedges, hiding from the inclement weather. The countryside is the topic I set for our contributors to this edition of the magazine. I grew up not just a townie, but a Londoner, and my formative introduction to the green and pleasant lands that lay outside the capital was twofold. Travelling along the A40 to West Wales to see my grandparents each summer, and through the AA Book of the Countryside. And what an encyclopedic book that was. Bats, birds, bricks, cottages, churches, deer parks, eel and fish, you name it, it was in there, A to Z. I spent hours reading the entries and poring over the illustrations. I have a copy still and occasionally take it down from the bookshelf for a refresher. In the first of today's items, Margaret Hibble shares her connection to the countryside around Sudbury. Margaret can't be here today, so I will be reading for her. As a child, I grew up in Sudbury, and my only access to the countryside was walking on Sudbury water meadows, known as Sudbury Commonlands. I was born during World War II and didn't really travel far out of Sudbury until I left school and found myself cycling to my laboratory job at Stafford Allen, later known as Bush Boke Allen, a factory making flavours and fragrances. I loved the early morning ride to Liston, a small village on the Suffolk-Essex border. I cycled over the bridge at Rodbridge and then along country lanes between fields and under trees and felt as if I was the only person in this beautiful countryside. Soon after leaving school, I met my future husband at my church tennis club. As we got to know each other, I discovered that he was soon to become a Freeman of Sudbury. I had never heard of this society, and over the next few years, I gradually learnt what it meant to be a Freeman. The term Freeman goes back to the early years of the 16th century, when the Lords of the Manor passed their authority to the boroughs, and the burgesses of the town became freemen. Sons of freemen were admitted to the freedom of the borough when they reached the age of 21 years, later changed to 18 years of age. Freedom was also granted to a young man who had served a 7-year apprenticeship to a freeman. For centuries, the freemen of Sudbury had rights of pasturage on Sudbury common lands. One of the privileges of a freeman was to be able to graze 2 cows on these meadows, which I believe is still valid today. Another privilege which still exists today is that for civic events in the town, 2 freemen in full regalia accompany the mayor as mace bearers. They carry large ceremonial silver maces, which I am assured are extremely heavy. My husband was admitted to the freedom of Sudbury in 1964, being the son of a freeman. This line is documented to go back to at least the 1700s. More recently, women were able to come freemen, and also grandchildren from the age of 18, always being direct descendants of freemen. This means that my family connection now includes my husband, daughter, son, and three of my grandchildren. As I walk the meadows today, it feels even more special knowing that our family have been connected with this beautiful countryside for generations. Thank you, Margaret. I doubt there are very many families whose history is so intertwined with Sudbury as yours. John King now takes us far, far away in his enjoyment of the countryside.
Well, the experience of the countryside very much depends on which country we're in and where we are located within that country. Also pertinent is the season. Within the UK, which is a climate classified as temperate, we are blessed with a wide variety of countryside to enjoy, each area having its own charms. We can wander through the grounds of big estates, wear ourselves out in the Peak District, enjoy the beauty of the Lake District and the coves of Cornwall. Scotland, Wales and Ireland all have their beautiful countryside. This article is being written in East Anglia, Suffolk, in particular, where we have beautiful hedges and meadows, slow meandering rivers, and in August, fields of golden cereal. We have a popular, very attractive coast, and the big skies and salt marshes of Norfolk are within easy and reasonable reach. Anyone who travels or reads sufficiently realises, of course, that across the world, countryside experiences are very different from ours and may require thought and consideration when venturing out. A stark reminder of this was the demise of Dr. Michael Mosley, who died in the summer heat of Greece, a not too distant country from us. My wife and I suffered on a walk in exactly the same area. Fortunately, we were with a group of experienced walkers to see us safe. Another point to bear in mind is that almost all we see in the country and across much of the world has been shaped by human intervention. And although charming and loved, it is very far from natural. This brings me to another aspect of the countryside, which is that it is teeming with wildlife. We are of course witness to this as we watch the swallows and swifts and the martins swooping through the summer sky, or the blackbirds and thrushes, robins and sparrows in the garden, and the starlings performing their amazing murmurations, and so on. There are the rabbits and the hares caught in the headlights, and the deer, probably too many deer, also the foxes who have moved into the towns, but the evidence still widely seen in the country. Let us try to forget about the pigeons. The thing is that just like us, they all die. Many get injured and, of course, become ill. There is no warm bed for them, no hospital, and, of course, they are easy prey for the predators, who themselves will suffer the same fate. Yet we do not see the countryside littered with bodies. No, the system clears up quickly by predators, carrion eaters, and rapid decay. But however you view it, nature is harsh and uncaring, cruel even. It only really cares about the survival of the species. Life would be just as harsh for us had we not developed as we have, and it must have been dreadful for the early humanoids. My final point concerns another benefit of the open countryside, and that is the view of the sky on a clear night, unobscured by light pollution. There you can view the full majesty of the Milky Way, our galaxy. Actually, all the stars you can see in the naked eye are in the Milky Way, except that on a good night you may just see our galactic neighbour Andromeda as a fuzzy little blob. Just to put us all in our place, there was estimated to be 200 to 300 billion galaxies. The latest estimates based on observations by the James Webb Telescope extend that to a trillion, our home galaxy being one amongst them. Our star, the Sun, is one of 100 to 400 billion stars in our galaxy, and we live on a speck in orbit around it. That is ego-busting. But maybe we are on the only planet with advanced life forms, and that is very lonely, and lands us with the responsibility not to kill ourselves, as all of the universe, without anyone to observe it, would seem pointless. But then, perhaps it's pointless anyway.
Thank you very much, John, for your thoughtful account of animal life in the countryside around us and beyond. Our next item was written by Jenny Finch. For reasons that will become apparent, Jenny isn't in the studio with us, and so I will be reading for her. Very recently, 2 weeks ago as it happens, I returned for a short visit to dear old Sudbury. Well, to be absolutely accurate, to the village 6.5 miles to the south of Sudbury, where we had lived for 21 wonderful years. Something of a pilgrimage, really. Enough to say, reviving old memories and revisiting places that had meant such a lot to us in the many years we'd lived in this area. Pilgrimage? Well, sadly, Michael, my husband of nearly 60 years, died a year ago. So it was with our daughter and 2 grandchildren I came back to what for me is a very special place and the real countryside. I say that because I now live in Wiltshire, and a lot of people seem to think that's the real countryside. It is beautiful. In places, well, let's face it, the New Forest is only just up the road from where I live. But it feels, and if I say, a bit overused, I hope you'll know what I mean. It's just too busy. Too much traffic. Too many people. And most of all, it never seems to achieve the wonderful peace of the real countryside. Sorry, Wiltshire. Too many tourists as well. So the lovely, wide, gentle landscapes of North Essex and South Suffolk looks wonderful to me. Fresh and most of all, quiet. You may not agree because you live here, but believe me, compared to so many places in our country, this area is still peacefully quiet. And even more amazingly, hardly changed. Let's hope it stays that way too. Like everyone else, like everywhere else, there's more housing and still going up in the area than when I moved away 10 years ago. But thankfully, it hasn't changed the feel and nature of the surrounding countryside. Those wonderful, long, uninterrupted views over farmland and fields, picture-perfect villages and nice market towns all do so much to restore calm and lift the spirits. Now, you could be forgiven for thinking I was born and bred here. Not so. Born in London and lived for the first 22 years of my life in the smoke. It wasn't until a chance to stay with a friend on her aunt's farm in a very remote area of North Essex when we were both 8 that I had the remotest idea what the term the countryside meant. To me, Wimbledon Common was the country. That was before the Wombles took over. So the visit to the farm must have had a profound effect, because although its primitive conditions made depressing and not so affluent 1950s London seem positive luxurious by comparison, it didn't seem to matter. It had no mains water, no electricity, an outside loo, complete with spiders, and there was an awful lot of mud. Though apparently, I loved it all. Again, it had to be the open space, the routine and rhythm of rural life and the precious quiet. Subconsciously, that's what got into my bones all those years ago, to become a lifelong love for the countryside. Not a total nature lover, though. Still hate spiders. And on a visit to a cousin's cottage in rural Wales in the summer, opened my bedroom door one night and, horror of horrors, was confronted by a very large bat that persisted in fluttering frantically around my head until I, not it, escaped. Anyone know the Welsh for wimp? Thank you, Jenny. It's lovely to know that North Essex and South Suffolk still hold such a lovely, special place in your heart. And I think that the Welsh for wimp begins clytiau lle something, but it translates as dishcloth. So that's as close as you're going to get. And now let's get those grey cells warmed up. Here's Ian Etherton with this month's quiz.
Question number one. In The Sound of Music, how many boys are in the Von Trapp family? In The Sound of Music, how many boys are in the Von Trapp family? Question number two. Lisbon is the capital of which country? Lisbon is the capital of which country? Question number three. Who was King Henry VIII's first wife? Who was King Henry VIII's first wife? Question number four. The name of which board game means I play in Latin? The name of which board game means I play in Latin? Question number five. Which breed of bird was used in mines to detect dangerous gases? Which breed of bird was used in mines to detect dangerous gases? Question number six. How many points is the blue ball worth in snooker? How many points is the blue ball worth in snooker? Question number seven. In the Harry Potter books, what is the name of Harry's owl? In the Harry Potter books, what is the name of Harry's owl? Question number eight. In Roman numerals, which letter represents the number 10? In Roman numerals, which letter represents the number 10? Question number nine. What is protected by the cranium? What is protected by the cranium? And question number 10. Which popular song begins with the lines, "At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side"? Which popular song begins with the lines, "At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side"?
Thank you, Ian. You caught me out with that very first question, so I'll listen with interest to the answers later. Here now is Margaret King with All the Shades of the Countryside, Light, Dark and in Between.
The countryside, our countryside. By that I mean the United Kingdom. Definition: rural areas away from towns and cities. Evidence of countryside. Yes, I imagine that the UK has some of the most beautiful countryside in the world. Our well-run national parks monitor and control much of our most visited areas. Yet still, in this overcrowded country, we can boast woodland, forest, rugged moorland, hills, dales, mountains, and swathes of open spaces. Not to mention a myriad of lakes, streams, and mighty meandering rivers, plus some really spectacular waterfalls. The added bonus, of course, is that being an island nation, we are lucky enough to be surrounded by much varied ocean scenery, cliffs, some monumental, others seriously crumbling away, dunes, large stretches of sandy beaches, and many picturesque bays and coves. This, to name just a few aspects. I am sure that I have missed out many, but it gives an idea of the huge variety of countryside that we are lucky enough to enjoy. Living in a country with a temperate climate, one which changes seasonally throughout the year, we are truly doubly blessed. We variously enjoy, depending of course upon your own personal proclivities, winter, spring, summer, autumn. Currently we are in the latter, the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, as John Keats would have it. Ted Hughes, in his poem Autumn Song, has a completely different take upon it. There came a day that caught the summer, wrung its neck, plucked it, and ate it. Yes, indeed. So let's focus upon the autumnal countryside, the spectacular colours of leaf changes, the red and purple berries on bushes and trees, the ploughed, harrowed and set fields, the fantastical display of mushrooms and toadstools, and the abundance of our native fruits, apples, pears, plums and pumpkins. Pumpkins, a bumper crop this year apparently, all coming to fruition as the evenings gradually darken. And then November, particularly late November. Not at all my favourite time. I refer you to the Thomas Hood poem entitled No, whose final lines are, no shade, no sign, no butterflies, no bees, no fruits, no flowers, no leaves, no birds, November. It's very clear that over the centuries, many writers and poets have eulogised over the natural beauty of our countryside. Nowadays, we hear endless news reports of the damage being wrought by too much development, overbuilding of industrial and housing estates, and Sizewell C. But let's not go there. Protesters who can see no other way preserving the countryside as we know it, and often their own splendid views, home in upon the destruction of wildlife, the birds, the badgers, the foxes, even the insects who will suffer, and of course the fish, if rivers are involved. It's hard to see how to hit the happy medium between necessity and harm, in fact a thankless task for any decision-making forum. Another environmental concern, and one which I know has been focused upon and taught in schools for nigh on 30 years, is the ever-constant horror of thoughtless littering. That is, of packaging of all kinds, plastic and glass bottles, drink tins, takeaway remnants, etc. Even worse is the sheer vandalism of fly-tipping. Yet an inveterate minority in the community still seem compelled to continue with these practices. In our village alone, a good number of volunteers litter pick regularly, and many also take part in spring and autumn organised picks. A vast number of bags are filled, the final contents of which make for an engaging read. Spoiler alert. A large collection of empty vodka bottles usually top the list. Leaving aside all comments upon this subject, whether appalled, humorous or sarcastic, it is a sad reflection that some people can show such little concern for the beauty of our countryside, while the majority of us really appreciate it, whether via walks, trips, holidays, or just with passive enjoyment.
Thank you, Margaret. There's no getting away from the human effect, from the way humans affect the countryside. But for me, nature and the poets win out every time. Let's join Ken Watkins now for a tour of the English and Welsh countryside, as he shares fond memories of the places he has lived.
I grew up in the big city. Well, it seemed quite big when I was a child. Coventry was where I was born and spent the first 20 years of my life. And in the 1940s and 1950s, the countryside wasn't too far away. Four of us, friends from the Cubs and Scouts, spent a few summers camping on a farm in a village a few miles outside the city. One of the parents was friends with the farmer. So we cycled out there, pitched our tents, and stayed for a few days. If memory serves me well, at a distance of around 70 years, the summers were always fine when we stayed on the farm. I think our diet was mainly baked beans, jacket potatoes and bread, supplemented by eggs from the chickens there, and fresh milk, almost, but not quite, straight from the cow. It was there that we were allowed to milk one of the cows by hand, the oldest one of the small herd, and very patient. The milk came out warm and then had to go through the cooler before we were allowed to drink it. I think today drinking unpasteurised milk would be regarded as a serious health and safety breach, but the farm family drank it then, and life was certainly different in those days. Some years later, and the year after getting married, work took me to Derbyshire, where we bought our first house. It backed onto fields with footpaths, so we were able to enjoy the countryside simply by walking out the back door, down the garden, and across a bridge over a stream. Then you could go for miles, weather permitting, or I could go out for a run in a bid to keep fit. And of course, we had the Peak District with all its delights, just a few miles away. In Lancashire, we lived in a village right next to fields, and those fields had horses in them, a plentiful source of manure for the side garden, which we turned over to vegetables. Not totally self-sufficient, perhaps, but it was always a pleasure to go out and pick something fresh to eat for much of the year. It wasn't until we moved to Suffolk, after a spell of town living, that we were able to start growing our own again. The cottage at Alfeaton had over 2 acres of land, divided into paddocks. So, having rented out a large part to friends who had horses, the rest provided an opportunity to grow our own once more. We invested in a polytunnel, and apart from 1 year of slim pickings, it delivered a veritable cornucopia of fresh food. The property, many years earlier, had been a small holding, fertile territory. So it came with apple trees and blackberry bushes, which provided a delightful and delicious addition to the menu. Alfeaton was a wonderfully close community, and it was a joy to live in the village, join in events, and delight at the changing scenery of the farming year. But of course, the drawback with country living, or beyond the back of beyond, as my son dubbed it, was the almost total lack of public transport and no shops. So a car was absolutely essential. Over the 21 years we lived in the village, a number of people moved out to be nearer both family and facilities because health grounds meant they could no longer drive. And some 11 years after I retired, we made the same decision to move into a town. The choice was Sudbury or Barry, the latter my wife's hometown, and where we'd lived previously when I worked in Cardiff. So now I live in Barry, the biggest town in Wales. And of course, public transport is better. There are shops and supermarkets, a surgery and a dentist just a few minutes' walk away, and Cardiff, with all that a capital city offers, is less than half an hour away by train, which cuts out the hassle of trying to find somewhere to park in the city centre. And we have a country park on the edge of Barry within walking distance, which is massive. Plus, the lovely countryside of the Vale of Glamorgan is just a short drive away. Not to mention the 5 beaches that Barry boasts. Do I miss living in the countryside? And would I want to do it again? If I were 30 to 40 years younger, then yes. And certainly the years we enjoyed in Alfeaton were some of the best. It's a lovely memory, and I guess it's going to have to stay that way.
Thank you, Ken. As an avid reader of Enid Blyton's stories, your childhood adventures sound idyllic to me. Julie Thompson had some childhood adventures of her own, and she is here now to tell us about them.
I've always considered myself a girl of the countryside. Our house backed onto farmers' fields when every year's crop became a carpet of golden wheat. The view from my bedroom window was a joy to my young eyes, but much more exciting was the harvest time. Huge machinery passing by the hedgerow at the bottom of our garden. The noise, the dust and the drama. That feeling has never left me, and I still feel as excited as the 10-year-old me whenever I hear or see a combine harvester. Our childhood gang would meet at the edge of the field once the combine had moved to what our parents called a safe distance. We would watch the hares darting from their hiding places at the very last moment, just escaping before that mechanical monster took their ears off. The very best bit, though, was our gang working as a team to collect and pile up the straw into huge mounds next to the towering oak tree, then taking it in turns to climb up to its bountiful branches before jumping off into our huge golden haystack. Happy memories of a life when it was carefree, uncomplicated, and as I realise now, the best days of our lives. But I can't talk about the countryside, though, without thinking of one of my favourite poets, John Clare. Have you heard of him? He was born in the late 18th century, up near Peterborough, and was the son of a farm labourer. The poor man had a troubled life, but he was influenced by the countryside and its wildlife to write some marvellous poetry. Here's a few lines from one of them now. Mouse's Nest. I found a ball of grass among the hay and progged it as I passed and went away. And when I looked, I fancied something stirred and turned again and hoped to catch the bird. When out, an old mouse bolted in the wheats with all her young ones hanging at her teats. What a beautiful sight that must have been. I've been very lucky to grow up in Suffolk, and although I've moved from my town of birth, I'm still less than 20 miles away and within 50 miles of where my granddad was born back in 1912. I've travelled the world and have enjoyed that tremendously, but I appreciate the beauty of the United Kingdom, its varied landscapes, but there's something about Suffolk, and I think that it's our beautiful countryside that keeps me calling this place home.
Thank you, Julie. I really enjoyed the image of you free falling out of that big old oak onto the hay. Best days indeed. And now, back with those quiz answers you've been waiting for, here's Ian Etherton.
Question number one. In The Sound of Music, how many boys are in the Von Trapp family? Answer, two. Question number two. Lisbon is the capital of which country? Answer, Portugal. Question number three. Who was King Henry VIII's first wife? Answer, Catherine of Aragon. Question number four. The name of which board game means I play in Latin? Answer, Ludo. Question number five. Which breed of bird was used in mines to detect dangerous gases? Answer, canary. Question number six. How many points is the blue ball worth in snooker? Answer, five. Question number seven. In the Harry Potter books, what is the name of Harry's owl? Answer, Hedwig. Question number eight. In Roman numerals, which letter represents the number 10? Answer, X. Question number 9. What is protected by the cranium? Answer, the brain. Question number 10. Which popular song begins with the lines, "At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side"? Answer, "I Will Survive".
Thank you, Ian, and I only hope that our listeners fared better than I did. In our final item of the evening now, we're on an excursion with Toby Jacobs, read for us today by Ken Watkins.
Have you ever noticed how many daily routines we have? How many of the same things we do day after day without realizing it? Well, this is the first of a series of articles dedicated to change, where we will challenge the set patterns of our lives. To go left instead of right, east instead of west, and to find out what was there all the time, if only we'd changed our mindset. Along the Essex and Suffolk borders, we are truly blessed with wonderful scenery, history and nature providing a myriad of opportunities to go out and about. However, it's amazing how many people you meet who rarely leave their own town or village. Today, I would like to recall to you a recent trip that I made to the small hamlet of Middleton in Essex. It sounds quite far away, but in fact, it's only a 10-minute drive from Sudbury. I'd driven past the signpost dozens of times en route to the Henny Swan pub, but had never turned right until now. There's something quite delicious about exploring virgin territory, and the feeling of turning right at the familiar signpost filled me with excitement. I had intended on focusing my attention on the parish church of All Saints, and as I drove towards the hamlet, I spotted a rather rustic-looking sign indicating that the church was down a narrow track to my right. As I drove along, what opened up before me was quite unexpected. To my left was a capacious area of manicured lawn, flanked by a majestic early 19th century house called Queen's Beeches. If you like the simplicity of Suffolk white bricks and large sash windows, then this residence would impress. I pulled into a small lay-by marked as church parking. On leaving the car, I was immediately confronted by the most wonderful view of the church, complete with a large pond in the foreground. There were some remains of a stone balustrade adjacent to the water and a lone bench keeping watch. You could just imagine warm days spent boating with Victorian ladies in all their finery. It was completely quiet and there was a very special atmosphere. The church sat slightly uphill and looked down on an ancient churchyard. Some of the older headstones were almost completely covered in lichen, but the copper plate script could still just about be seen. The Grade 1 listed church dates from the 1150s, but has a more recent bell tower addition. The exterior walls were rendered in traditional lime plaster of a warming creamy hue. I approached the entrance porch, where a large door, which looked like oak, had been bleached grey by the years. It had a surround of very ornate brickwork, forming into a pleasing Norman arch. As I reached for the old iron latch, the full weight of the door became apparent. The smell of thyme enveloped me as I stepped forward into the darkness, and the temperature dropped considerably. It never fails to surprise me how cold these old churches stay, regardless of the outside weather. The interior was divided into two areas, the larger of which had a wooden vaulted ceiling. There were many stained glass windows, some depicting biblical scenes, and some dedicated to former worshippers. On the floor were a couple of large flagstones with very decorative engravings. One of them was in memory of a former rector and his young family. They'd all passed away within a year of each other, so we can only assume it was due to illness or disease. There was a large organ to one side and some stalls for the choir. By now, the chill was getting into my bones, so I decided to make a hasty retreat, out into the relative warmth of a March day. As I drove back down the narrow track, I decided to take the scenic route home. So, on reaching the main road, I turned right, towards the top of the Essex side of the Stour Valley. All of a sudden, the view opened out onto an amazing vista of Sudbury and Great Cornard, nestling quietly down on the valley floor. I wanted to stop the car and get out, but the road was very narrow and there was nowhere to pull over. As I drove onward, the road got ever tighter. A lovely yellow field of rapeseed appeared to my left. By now, the hedgerows were almost touching the sides of the car. I had visions of a large combine harvester appearing ahead of me and having to reverse uphill. Thankfully, I reached the wider road to Henney and breathed a sigh of relief. As a city boy, I still find these country lanes rather disconcerting. But my trip into the unknown had been a success, all because I turned right at the crossroads. I hope you enjoyed this tale. Until the next time.
Thank you, Toby. Descriptive, atmospheric, and a reminder, if it were needed, that we really don't need to go far to enjoy a day out. Thanks also to Ken Watkins for reading for us. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this November's magazine as much as I have. My thanks to all of our volunteers for their contributions, to our technician Dave Sullivan, and to you for listening. This is our last magazine recording before Christmas. So Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you all. And until next time, goodbye.